KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum, a new study of a drug used for diabetes suggests serious possible consequences and raises serious questions about regulation and the role of the FDA. We'll find out all about it in the hour coming up and why there is controversy. Forum is next after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum. Avandia, also known as rosiglitazone, is a pill that's used to control type 2 diabetes, the most common form of diabetes and the one linked to obesity. According to a recently published study in the New England Journal of Medicine, it raises the risk of both heart attacks and death. And over 6 million people have taken Avandia since it came out in the market in 1999. Currently, about a million take the drug. The Federal Drug Administration issued a safety alert but did not go through with a recall, and critics of the FDA say the drug should have been pulled from the market or should be pulled, and even before this study was published. Others feel much more study is necessary. So in this hour of forum, we want to sort through this, not only find out about Avandia, but also talk about regulation of drugs and how all that works. And first, we want to talk with Dr. Stephen Nissen, who is chair of the cardiovascular medicine unit over at Cleveland Clinic and co-author of the New England Journal of Medicine report on the effects of Avandia on heart attacks. And welcome. Good to have you here, Dr. Nissen.
Great to be with you.
First question for you is, how has this been received? Because I'm getting kind of mixed reports. On the one hand, the suggestion is that it's being received as being sort of the be-all and end-all. On the other hand, it's kind of what we call a meta-study, not a clinical trial. So,
It's been received very well, and it was intended to be not the be-all and end-all. We'd be the first to tell you that a meta-analysis, which combines the results of many trials, is not as definitive as doing a single large study that's designed to answer a specific question. Nonetheless, we think that the results are striking. It's a pretty large treatment effect, a 43% increase in the risk of heart attack, and as much as a 64% increase in risk of death from cardiovascular causes, that we felt that information had to get out there.
Those are pretty dramatic numbers.
They are. And I guess you raise the issue of drug regulation, and one of the things that's very disappointing is that the company's own internal analysis also revealed a hazard in September of 2005, and they informed the FDA that they had observed a hazard with the drug, and neither the company or the FDA told anyone in the patient community nor in the provider community. And that's why there's a lot of discussion now about the regulatory failures.
The company we ought to name is GlaxoSmithKline.
That's right.
We need more studies about risk here, though, don't we?
Not everybody agrees that we need more studies. There are certainly people within the FDA that have very strong views about taking actions immediately. And part of the reason is that there are safer alternatives, it appears. There are other drugs in the class, at least one other drug in the class, that appears not to have that risk. And this drug has no unique benefits. It's never been shown to have any favorable effects on any health outcomes. The only thing it does is lower blood sugar. But the reason you lower blood sugar is to avoid the complications of diabetes, the most feared of which is heart disease. And it is pretty clear that the cardiovascular events, the heart disease events, are going in the wrong direction.
Well, when you got a 64% cardiovascular-related death rate, and where do you come up with that number? How does that emerge?
What happens is you take a meta-analysis is very complex mathematically, but what you do is each of the trials compares the two groups, the group that got Avandia and the group that got other drugs. From that comparison, you get a relative risk. How much is the risk up or down? And then you combine those trials mathematically to get a kind of a summary risk, and that's what a meta-analysis is. Now, it's also very important for your listeners to understand that there are some substantial weaknesses in our study. We didn't have access to the original clinical trial data. We were using data that was derived from publicly available sources, which is not as solid, not as reliable. So we don't have everything here, but the FDA does, and the company does. And what we call for is for the agency and the company to urgently analyze all of the data and tell us what they have. And as soon as they do that, they can either reassure us or they can make a regulatory decision about the drug.
We should mention that we made several calls to GlaxoSmithKline for comment, but we did not receive response from them. At this point, is this falling on deaf ears, or what's happening with the urging that you're doing?
Well, unfortunately, the FDA is an agency that is in terrible trouble, and it's continued to have difficulty with drug safety. There's internal, battles that go on at the agency between the Drug Safety Division and the Office of New Drugs. And the primary problem here is that the people responsible for approving the drug are also the ones that are responsible deciding when there has to be a safety relabeling. And so it's very hard for them to say, we made a mistake. We let this drug out there, and it turned out not to be a good drug. What is quite remarkable about Avandia is if you go back and look at the original five trials that led to the drug's approval, there are more cardiovascular events in the Avandia group, substantially more, than in the control group. Now, it's not statistically significant, but this signal that the drug was causing harm to the heart has been there from day one.
There's also some studies that show fractures in women and blindness and other things as well.
And those are issues that should not be an issue on withdrawal. That's a labeling issue. We need to know about them. And we need to know about the risk of congestive heart failure. The problem with the risks that we observed is that they're irrevocable. A heart attack or death are irrevocable events. And that's why, the fact that the FDA has sat on these data for so long has caused the Congress to be so angry about this particular case.
Well, there is a congressional hearing slated, we should mention.
June the 6th.
June the 6th, yeah. And we appreciate very much, Stephen Nissen, your being with us. Stephen Nissen, again, along with Kathy Wolski, wrote the article that appears in the New England Journal of Medicine, and it is pretty much about Avandia and the effects that it has, particularly on the heart and related to death. And again, we thank you.
You bet.
Let me introduce the other people who are going to be with us in this morning's hour. David Magnus directs the Stanford Center for Biomedical Ethics. He joins us by ISDN line, which is as good as having him here. We'll have him on here in a moment. Dr. Karen Earle is here with us in studio. She's medical director for the Center for Diabetes Services and chief of the Division of Endocrinology at California Pacific Medical Center. Welcome.
Thank you.
And Dr. Kurt Furberg joins us as well by phone this morning. He's professor of public health sciences at Wake Forest University School of Medicine. Welcome, Dr. Furberg.
Thank you very much.
And let me go to you, Dr. Furberg.
Sure.
FDA has been sort of out of the loop in all these other studies, and yet we see all the hype with this one study. Why is that?
Well, as Dr. Nissen pointed out, they have a difficult situation. Drug are rushed to for approval, get on the market before we have good information about efficacy and safety. And then when you have a safety problem, the question is raised, why did you approve it the first time around? So they're almost always on the defense. They have to defend decisions that are probably not very good ones. And that's what we are seeing here. They get very defensive, very annoyed if you raise issues.
Now, are we talking about defensiveness from GlaxoSmithKline or from the FDA or both?
From the FDA. They are defensive. The company has other reasons for being defensive. They are in business of making money, of selling drugs. So they're afraid that this is going to cut into their profit.
You sound amazingly, to a degree, like Congressman Tom Lantos. I don't know if you've ever heard him speak, our local congressman here from San Mateo. But let me get to the heart of this. The FDA should have pulled this, basically, is what you're saying, isn't it?
Well, I maybe I disagree a little bit with Dr. Nissen. I mean, to me, you always look at the totality of the benefit, totality of the harm. And in terms of benefit, ain't much. Lowers blood sugar. And that's the extent of it. And then from that you assume that it's going to have some health benefits, but that has never been proven.
What do you see as the problems with the FDA?
Well, but let me get to the other issue about the harm. So one is that, yes, it increases the risk of heart attacks by 40-50%. It increases the risk of heart failure by 2-3-fold, doubles the risk of heart or fractures in women. And then more and more reports about an eye condition that leads to blindness. So to me, you add that up. I don't think any of those individually would be a reason to pulling the drug, but the collectively, absolutely. I would discourage people from using it, and those who are on it, to talk to their doctors and ask to be put on something that is less harmful.
And I'm looking at something from the Washington Post where you're quoted as saying the FDA has for the past decade been aware of these problems. They've done very little to fix them. Why, in your judgment?
Well, the I think it goes back to how drugs are approved. The issue here is that for drugs for the treatment of diabetes, it's enough to show that the drug lowers blood sugar. And we've learned a lot of lessons from approving drugs based on that. We have other examples where drugs were approved for ventricular arrhythmias, and people said if they prevent arrhythmias, we're going to reduce sudden death. Well, it's the other way around. It increased it. We have drugs used to improve the density of bones so you can reduce fractures. Didn't work. We have the latest one, the hormone replacement therapy, estrogen, supposed to lower heart attacks because it lowered cholesterol, the bad cholesterol, and raised the good ones. It should have reduced heart attacks by 30-40%. Didn't. So over and over again, we're making mistakes by relying on what we call surrogate outcomes. We need to be stricter and focus on what's good for the patients, the health benefits.
Dr. Kurt Furberg, again, is professor of public health sciences at Wake Forest University School of Medicine. Dr. Karen Earle, here with us in studio, is medical director for the Center for Diabetes Services and chief of the Division of Endocrinology at California Pacific Medical Center. Dr. Earle, you don't think that necessarily the FDA ought to be held responsible here. Why?
Well, I think the FDA is in a really tight spot in that there is definitely a lot of push for medications, new medications, to be approved by the FDA as soon as possible because there's potential benefit for patients. And so I do think that we have to be able to look at endpoints that are feasible in a short amount of time. So sometimes to look at these health benefits, you need to have endpoints 10 years out, and that's just not reasonable prior to approval of a drug. Sometimes also you need very large numbers of patients to really see effects, particularly small adverse outcomes, which again isn't always feasible prior to approval of a drug. So I think it would be hard to get new medications out there if we had such strict criteria for approval. What perhaps needs to be investigated further is once drugs are approved, we can then go into the bigger clinical trials looking for these endpoints that are harder to discover. And so I think there needs to be more push for these after FDA approval trials.
We keep hearing, though, that the FDA doesn't have enough money, they don't have enough expertise, they don't get enough congressional direction.
These are all true.
So there may be things getting to market perhaps faster than they should be or slower than they should be. In many cases, that's indeed the...
Right. And so I think that you could argue that there are drugs that are taking too long to get through the FDA because of the criteria that they have. In terms of the endpoints that they're looking at, so, you know, basically right now, most of the drugs for diabetes, the endpoint is reduction of blood sugars or a marker for blood sugars, which is called the hemoglobin A1C. And that's been something that's used across the board on all the medicines that are being approved for diabetes. And the reason why we use that is there have been these large clinical trials looking at tight control of diabetes, preventing outcomes and preventing adverse outcomes. And those outcomes that we're looking at are both small vessel diseases, such as eye disease, kidney disease, and nerve disease, as well as the big vessel diseases, such as cardiovascular endpoints, heart attacks, and strokes. So there's good evidence that sugar control relates to decreased bad outcomes. And as I mentioned, it's hard to really look at all those outcomes in some of these clinical trials.
So you would recommend that patients continue to take this drug?
No. Not necessarily. I think it needs to be evaluated. What I'm recommending for patients who are on the drug, and one of the most important things I'd like to say is don't panic. Don't stop taking your medicine. I just mentioned that bad blood sugar control contributes to bad outcomes. So what I don't want people to do is to hear all this press and all of a sudden stop taking their medications and have their diabetes go out of control, because that would definitely be a bad idea.
What about the other drugs that are in the same class that were removed from the market by the FDA?
Right. There's two earlier drugs that were already removed. The first one, troglitazone, was removed for liver disease. And there's another one, moraglitazar, that never got FDA approval due to cardiovascular effects.
This study that we talked about with Dr. Nissen that he was co-author on, it was done initially, as I understand it, to talk about the drug's benefits or to look at the drug's benefits.
That's absolutely.
A real irony in that.
Yes, and this has happened before. For example, the big clinical trials done on hormone replacement therapy were to promote hormone replacement therapy, and then they found out it wasn't so good. So this has certainly happened before. But I think what's different is that the studies were actually published that demonstrated some benefit of this medication, and it wasn't until you sort of combined all the data into this meta-analysis that the bad outcomes really were revealed.
And Dr. Karen Earle is Medical Director for the Center for Diabetes Services and Chief of the Division of Endocrinology at California Pacific Medical Center. David Magnus directs the Stanford Center for Biomedical Ethics, and we have you on the line here, David Magnus. Good morning.
Good morning.
How does a bioethicist look at all of this? Particularly in the sense of what seems to be deleteriousness of this particular drug and the FDA's maybe, at least as some see it, Dr. Furberg, for example, not picking up the ball as quickly as they ought to be.
Right. I think there are a few points that that are important about this that touch on what's already been said. The first is when you have a new drug that's been approved based on surrogate endpoints or alternatively on basis of a placebo-controlled trial where there are already other existing drugs, it's important to note that you don't really know at that point whether or not this new drug is as good or better than existing drugs that are on the market, either in terms of efficacy or in terms of side effect. And so you've got to be concerned about that when a new drug is introduced. And one of the things that means is both that there needs to be adequate follow-up in terms of study, which has already been indicated as a problem with the FDA, but also I think it's important to think about prescribing patterns. One question is when you've got a new drug that's doesn't have evidence that it's better than existing drugs and might introduce new issues of risk, why would anybody use it unless existing drugs aren't effective? But that isn't, in fact, what prescribing patterns usually are because of marketing. So the drug companies will market new drugs even if there's no evidence that they're as good or better than existing drugs because either they don't have a drug in this class and they're trying to compete in a new market or because existing drugs are going off patent. And so our prescribing patterns are actually not really rational in terms of optimizing care for our patients. And so I think that's one set of problems that exists. And then the other question is in terms of the follow-up, the Institute of Medicine, the General Accounting Office, they've all criticized the FDA's aftermarket safety and tracking and monitoring system. There have been some proposals to make that better, but a lot of the responses have fallen short of what's been called for, partly because of a lack of funding, partly because of a lack of will, partly because of a lack of congressional action, so that our current system is just not where it needs to be.
We should mention we also called the FDA, and they declined to participate, along with GlaxoSmithKline, the company that's responsible for this drug. How much of negligence really belongs at their doorsteps? That is where GlaxoSmithKline is concerned. You always hear the criticism there. These pharmaceutical companies are looking for profit rather than public or patient safety. And how much is that part of the calculus in your judgment?
Well, I think you have to take into account what existing drugs are as well as what the new drugs are. So when you look in retrospect, the data that was available certainly makes it seem like this drug would not be as safe or effective as drugs that already exist. So you could question why this should have been approved in the first place. So I think the FDA is naturally going to come under some attack on that basis, and so it's understandable why they'd be defensive.
Well, Dr. Furberg, what about the warning labels that are now on this drug?
Well, the warning labels have very little effect. There have been studies showing that if you put in a black box warning Physicians don't pay much attention to it. It's not changing the way medicine is practiced. So that's not a very useful way of cutting back on use of drugs.
So, Kevin just handed me something that's, from Reuters that says that Avandia is Glaxo's second biggest seller, bringing in £1.6 billion. This is obviously British, converted to £3.16 billion and accounting for 7% of the group revenues, significantly more profits as we continue. Do we need, we've already said perhaps we need more studies here, Karen Earle, but what happens when the studies become contradictory or when they suggest different sorts of conclusions or different data?
This is a very confusing situation, and I think it's really up to the physicians to discuss this with their patients. Again, you're asking, should all these patients be stopping the medication? Should this be prescribed? I think it has to be really a discussion between the patient and the physician, saying, now we know that there are these potential risks. There are alternatives, and that's one thing that we have to, that people keep mentioning today, is that this is not the only medication for diabetes. There are other good alternatives, both oral agents and injectable agents like insulin.
Cheaper and less risky, too. Huh?
Cheaper and less risky.
But this is more popular. It has been more popular.
I don't know that it's necessarily more popular, but certainly there's some resistance to injection. So, you know, insulin, I think, works beautifully. I'm a big fan of using insulin in diabetics, but there's a lot of resistance on the part of both the physicians and the patients to sort of start insulin earlier because of the injections, because of the education that's required to use it appropriately.
I want to just one more question, if I may, David Magnus, to you, and then we're going to go to our callers. And that has to do just with, you know, Sidney Wolfe well, probably there's nobody like Sidney Wolfe, but people who are in the business of looking at these issues and trying to bring them to the public attention have been doing this with Avandia for quite a while here. Is there a better way? We certainly do our part or try to do our part, but is there a better way to make the public more aware of what some of these risks are in your judgment?
Well, I think that's also an interesting part of the problem. There's not a lot of transparency in certain parts of the system. So it was fortunate that there was public access to a lot of the data in this particular case, which made the meta-analysis possible, but up to now, industry and the FDA have resisted efforts to make the process even more transparent and to have real-time access to all of the clinical data, for example, that would have made it even better, made the studies even stronger. If that was possible and there was more transparency in the system, it would be easier to have people do follow-ups and have more information that they could get out to the public.
Is it possible that this congressional hearing slated for June 6, especially when you have Senator Grassley kind of on the stump here about this, that we'll see something reap from this?
It's an interesting it'll be interesting to see how this plays out. The IOM has some very definite proposals that there's some resistance to by industry and by the FDA. Some of the proposals are being piloted, but the other question that's going to arise is also going to be about funding. Some of the proposals are going to require additional staffing. Right now, a lot of the funding for this, the safety office, is actually coming from industry itself. Unfortunately, an unintended consequence of the war in Iraq is that this is one of many things where there's just not enough money for doing everything that may need to be done.
Again, David Magnus directs the Stanford Center for Biomedical Ethics. And again, I want to remind listeners, we asked GlaxoSmithKline as well as the FDA to participate. Both were not available, but our phones are available, and we welcome your calls. In fact, you can join us now toll-free at 866-733-6786. Again, that number for your phone calls, whether you're listening to us on radio, internet, or a Sirius satellite, 866-733-6786, or send us an email with a question or comment if you prefer. Email address is forum@kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. You're listening to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking about new findings about an ingredient in commonly prescribed diabetes drugs that may pose safety concerns. Avandia is the drug under focus here, but we're talking really about regulation and about safety of drugs. And Dr. Stephen Nissen joined us at the top of the hour, chairman of the Cardiovascular Medicine Unit at Cleveland Clinic, who is co-author of the report on the effects of Avandia, which appeared in the New England Journal of Medicine. With us for the rest of the hour is Dr. Kurt Furberg, professor of public health sciences at Wake Forest University School of Medicine, Dr. Karen Earle, who is medical director for the Center for Diabetes Services and chief of the Division of Endocrinology at California Pacific Medical Center, and David Magnus, director of the Stanford Center for Biomedical Ethics. We're going to go right to your calls, and I remind you that you can join us here at our toll-free number, 866-733-6786, or by email, and the email address is forum@kqed.org. Aaron, good morning. You're first up.
Hi. First of all, I think it's disgraceful that the FDA did not come on this show. They're a public agency, and that should mean they're accountable to the public. But my question is, what is the relationship between GlaxoSmithKline, the federal government, and the FDA? Hmm.
David Magnus, can you help us here?
Well, I mean, that's a hard question to answer. It's certainly the case that there is a tight connection between the FDA and the pharmaceutical industry with regard to the development of new drugs, as well as their monitoring, both in terms of at the individual level, there's often a lot of going back and forth and individuals going back and forth between working for the FDA and working for industry, and then also at the level of the funding from industry that really supports a lot of what the FDA is doing. So there is, in fact, a fairly tight connection between the two that has been criticized in the past, but they're not. Obviously, they're formally independent.
Dr. Ferber, can you
I can expand
illuminate
on that.
Here? Yeah, go ahead.
Yes. In 1992, there was a new act introduced, the Prescription Drug User Fee Act. So any drug company with a drug that they wanted approved had to pay the FDA a fee, a user fee. And this has been in effect now since 92. After that was introduced, as a condition for their money, by the way, from industry, the industry said, you need to accelerate the approval process. You have to meet our deadlines in order to qualify for the payments. And by the way, you cannot spend any money on safety. So for 10 years, all the money went into the FDA to support staff, only to look at the good effects, not the bad effects of the drug. And this has changed slightly now. But the issue is that the FDA depends on these funds, and the sense is that they need them. And I would say that you don't bite the hand that's feeding you. FDA is not a watchdog. To me, it's more a lapdog.
Let me thank the caller. That's one to inscribe. We go to more callers. Peter from Santa Rosa, good morning.
Good morning. This is Peter Beginsky. I'm a diabetes specialist in Santa Rosa, and I have a couple of comments about the statistics. When we talk on the media, it's not clear what this actually means. I think one can do a better job informing the listeners. When you said, Mr. Krasny, that there's a 64% cardiovascular death rate. Actually, that's what a lot of the listeners are hearing, but that's not correct. It's about 0.5%. It just means that there's an increased risk compared to the background, and I think people should get that clarification. But also, that 64% was not statistically significant, if I'm correct, Dr. Nissen. It was just
Dr. Nissen is no longer with us, but let me get Dr. Earle to comment on that. Karen Earle?
So I think that is a very good point. So when all 42 studies were combined, I think there was approximately 28,000 patients, and the event rate was over 100. So we're not saying that 63% of people on this medication are getting heart attacks. It's that the risk is increased
by
63%.
They're more at risk, yeah.
Correct.
Yeah. Thank you for clarifying that, because I'm concerned that it had not been clarified. Did you want to add anything to your comments?
You know, I just wanted to add one more thing. The tendency is to just go to the other drug in this class, which is Actos. But I wanted to point out it has a lot of the same side effects in terms of increased risk of the eye condition, fractures, congestive heart failure. And we don't have complete data that it is. There's a suggestion it may be safer, but it shouldn't be an automatic assumption that it is.
Same root ingredients, no, Dr. Rowe? Yeah.
Correct. So what's interesting about this class is that there are very individual adverse outcomes from the different medications within the class. But I think it certainly people should be cautious when if they're just switching from one thiazolidinedione to another, you know, there is certainly risk. There, however, was a big study done with the other agent, Actos or pioglitazone, which did not show cardiovascular risk.
Let me thank you, Peter, for your call. And we're going to go more of your calls here. We go to Davis. Bob, you're on. Good morning.
Yes. Can you hear me okay?
I can hear you fine.
My question, I'm not a medical person, but talking about the issue of obesity, everybody recognizes obesity is a national problem, but there's no strategic national approach to effectively try to deal with it. And one question is, why don't we try to take a comprehensive approach and create incentive and disincentives in the insurance and any number of ways that people could think of for people to have to deal with their own personal obesity issues?
Now, this has come up when we've done healthcare and insurance issues, but Dr. Furberg is in public health. Some thoughts from you, Kurt Furberg?
No, this is obviously a major public health problem. A lot of people have tried to address it. I don't see any simple solutions. You need patients to understand what's behind the obesity. It's a lifestyle issue. They're eating too much or exercising too little, and that's behind most of it. But I think we need educational programs and so on. And I wish we also had some drugs that could be used effectively, but the ones we have are not very good.
Let me thank the caller and look at some of the emails here. David Magnus, listener named Dave, says, why can't we just admit that no drug is really proven safe until it has been on the market for some time? A phase 3 does not have the statistical power to detect rare side effects. This is why phase 4s exist. Post-market recall should be considered successes of the FDA when they detect aftermarket side effects, not failures. However, I agree that phase 4 surveillance should be overhauled and made more robust.
So I completely agree that phase 3 trials by themselves are not going to be sufficient to detect problems at fairly low levels or in fairly common occurrences, as in this case. So it's, of course, the case that phase 4 is going to be necessary, and it's also the case that we need to overhaul the system when only 25% of the mandated phase 4 follow-up that the FDA required between 1998 and 2003 were actually done in a timely manner by industry. Clearly something is wrong with the regulatory system to be able to adequately do a job with that. But I still want to keep coming back to the other point, which is given that level of uncertainty, I think we have to be I think physicians need to be a little bit more cautious about prescribing new medications just because they're new and just because the drug rep that comes into the room enthusiastic about it when they provide them with their free lunch, that they don't just jump to whatever's new as opposed to existing drugs that may actually have a longer track record and therefore be safer and that work for their patients. Just because something is new, it may be better for the companies because it may be still on patent, but that doesn't necessarily mean it's either better or safer.
And Karen Earle, here's Clay who writes, Dr. Earle, I'd like to ask your take on the ideas of Nobel Prize-winning economist Milton Friedman, who suggests that we dismantle the FDA in favor of private voluntary safety certification. People who want safety can look for the seal of approval of their favorite safety certification lab. Those who are less cautious can take their chances with drugs that may well significantly improve their conditions but could conceivably harm them. One thing Friedman points out is how our nation requires not just that you prove safety, but efficacy, unlike Canada, for instance. The delays that can sometimes happen because FDA employees may not want to risk the fallout of a premature approval can often cause more harm than premature approval itself. Does this argument hold water in the eyes of a medical professional such as yourself?
Interesting question. You know, I think there does have to be some federal agency that's really overlooking all this. I don't think dismantling the FDA is the answer, but certainly some improvements in the way the existing organization runs would be of benefit.
And one more email from Pamela, who says, nothing can raise the risk of death as it is already 100%. It would be much more useful for the general listener, such as myself, to hear that it raises the risk of premature death through stroke or cancer or whatever. Let me go to more of your calls. Jonathan, good morning.
Yeah, hi. I have a question regarding access to data. The panelist who did the original study, or the study we're talking about, said that he was limited in that he couldn't get access to the clinical trial data, and that seems a bit absurd to me, and I'm wondering if there's any movement to get access to that data.
Yeah, David Magnus?
So there has been some movement to open up access to the details of that kind of data, but at this point there's very strong opposition to that from industry, and it doesn't look to me like the FDA is going to be moving in favor of that. So I think that's something that's going to require congressional action to happen.
Any potential for that congressional action as you see it, Dr. Furberg?
Yes, I think there is. Regulations related to registration of new trials. So every new product that's started has to be registered, and also the results have to be published within a certain time after the completion of the study. And major medical journals require that a trial be registered if they're going to publish the results. So there's pressure on them. The World Health Organization is involved. More and more pressure on the companies to let people know when they do trials and let them know about the outcomes.
But this is a question about more than just the outcomes. The question is, what about getting more details about and access to actual patient data in those trials?
Well, I don't think you can get individual patient data. You can get summary data, and that's part of the regulations.
Right, but so one concern is that may not be as much as people need, that there may be a need for more data than I
agree with it, and it's very easy for us to say, talk to your doctor. Well, come on, doctors don't have this information. They don't have access to they don't know where to find the information. So there's nowhere to go if you want to know all the bad effects of rosiglitazone. And the labeling is totally inadequate, and so... why should we refer to the doctors who wouldn't have the information?
Let me think, Jonathan. I want to go to another caller who's also on this point of transparency, and that's Michael. Good morning.
Hello?
Yes, sir. You're on the air.
Okay, thank you. I just have one comment. That an effective way, I believe, to help consumers that costs no one anything is to have each of these new drugs that comes on the market have to say in the ads in a meaningful way, this drug has not been proven to be more effective than any other drug, and has not been proven to be less dangerous than any other drug. And then let the consumer decide, unless, of course, these people have proof that those things are so.
Dr. Earle, some thoughts from you on this?
Well, I think it's difficult. You know, as mentioned, physicians don't have all the data, but patients certainly don't have all the data. So whenever I prescribe a medication that's new to one of my patients, I do discuss this is a new medication. It's only been approved for, 6 months, 2 years, however long it's been. And I do make them aware that there might be more data about the long-term side effects of this medication that haven't come out yet. Having said that, I think patients have to be careful because it can be really confusing. You know, we've already mentioned some confusion about what the 63% increased risk means. And so putting too much of the burden on the patient to do the research isn't fair. I think the physicians have to understand what these numbers mean, have to educate themselves, not just listening to the representatives that come and buy them lunch, but really do their research to know what the risks are.
You haven't addressed my point. My point was that this should be on the advertising put out by the drug companies on television and such that says this drug is not approved to be more effective or less dangerous than other drugs of the same type.
I think it's a wonderful idea, and it has been proposed to the FDA. And an advisory committee said, please do that for drugs for the treatment of hypertension. They voted 8-1 to support that recommendation, and the FDA ignored it. They don't want it.
Let me thank Michael for the call. I'm getting a picture from you, Dr. Furberg, of, if not an ineffectual FDA, an FDA that is certainly not serving the public as it should be or as it ideally can.
That is correct.
I mean, that may even be an understatement on my part from the way you feel, I think, huh?
No, but I think they do a good job in many respects, and we shouldn't forget about that. Medicine has changed quite a bit over the past decades. We have wonderful drugs, and we'll credit drug companies and the FDA, but there's another side to it, and that is on the safety horizon, we need major changes, major improvements.
We'll get to more of your calls. In fact, let me go to San Jose. John, you're on. Good morning.
Yes. At one time, it was not legal to advertise drugs, and it seems to me like the marketing and the hype and the thirst for profit has grown from that time. Could you ask each one of your guests what they think of?
Let me go to our resident bioethicist here first, David Magnus. How much do you see advertising in terms of selling and really with hurting what consumers may find they need in the way of information?
Yeah, in a way, it's a real dilemma in that when there is not direct consumer advertising. It's not that there's no advertising. It's that advertising is aimed primarily at physicians. And that's still where the bulk of the advertising dollars from the pharmaceutical industry goes, is actually direct to physician advertising as opposed to direct to consumer advertising.
But you do see a lot of drugs advertised on television.
Absolutely. It's been a growing segment, getting the patients to ask about the drugs in addition to the traditional ways of trying to influence physician prescribing habits. Both happen, and both have different sets of risks associated with them. If you've got, there's some people who have said that for drugs that are approved based solely on surrogate endpoints or that are new and you don't have enough data that you would really want for their safety, that there should not be any direct-to-consumer advertising for a certain period of time as one possible solution to help avoid that. But I think that even if we do that, that doesn't solve the problem as long as aggressive physician advertising continues to exist that lead to prescribing habits that we currently have, where drugs that are not as proven, not as safe, not as effective are prescribed, not because existing drugs have proven ineffective in those patients, but because those are the first drug of choice as a result of the marketing effort.
You want to weigh in here, Kurt Furberg?
Yes. The United States and New Zealand are the only two countries that allow direct-to-consumer advertising. There are several studies that have shown that they lead to overuse primarily of the non-essential drugs that are being promoted. And so there are efforts on the way to restrict advertising, but those efforts are running against the First Amendment freedom of commercial speech. So I don't know what's going to happen.
We'll go to more calls. Leslie, thanks for waiting. You're on Forum. Good morning.
Hi. I wanted to know, why aren't there more trials, like FDA trials, comparing the efficacy of older drugs versus new drugs before the drugs come on market?
Mm-hmm. Dr. Karen Earle.
The FDA isn't usually paying for these trials. It's the drug companies that manufacture the new products that are doing the trials. And so they obviously want to make their product look as good as possible. Now, keep in mind, there were studies with this medication, Avandia, comparing it to placebo, comparing it to metformin, which is one of the other medications commonly used, and comparing it to sulfonylureas. So there were trials comparing it to other medications. But again, most of the drug companies would prefer to use placebo, where their drug obviously will look much better.
Let me thank you for the call, Leslie, and we'll get more of your calls on here. And by the way, if you'd like to join us in the time remaining, it's toll-free 866-733-6786, or our email address is forum@kqed.org. And Lena, good morning.
Hi, Michael. It's Lena Berman from Your Own Health and Fitness. There's an important issue that's getting missed here. Diabetes is a confluence of symptoms. If it's caught in the early stages, it is primarily a disease of fight or flight. It's a stress-related disease. If you catch people early, you can control their blood sugars by controlling their diet, giving them some exercise, and controlling their stress. In fact, if you do that, you'll turn the thing around without drugs, and the studies that compare drugs to doing lifestyle intervention show that the drugs do not work very well and, in fact, stop working when the patient's around 60 or 55. In addition to that, insulin, which is frequently used, people with type 2 diabetes are often insulin resistant, which means that they have actually too much insulin, and the tissues begin to become desensitized to the message that insulin is sending to lower the blood sugar. So what happens is that you start flooding them with additional insulin by using insulin, and insulin itself is cardiotoxic. So the heart-related problems with diabetes are directly related to too much insulin.
Wait, let me go to Dr. Earle on this, because she was saying before she's bullish on insulin, so I think you wanted to respond to that.
I would love to respond to that. So it's really important to understand that type 2 diabetes is a combination of two different factors. There's insulin resistance, which certainly is part of the disease, but there's also failure of the beta cell. Those are the cells in the pancreas that make insulin. Particularly once you've had diabetes for 10, 20 years, many of those patients actually have very low levels of insulin at that point. And that's often the point where patients are on multiple medications and where I think insulin should be used earlier. To answer your earlier question, yes, diet and exercise work better than medications in prevention of diabetes, but quite honestly, as a physician, they are the hardest things for me to get my patients to do. I wish I could get my patients to do diet and exercise rather than medications. And even with diet and exercise, diabetes is a progressive disease, and so it might delay things, but certainly doesn't stop the progression.
Lena, we thank you for your call. Here's some emails. Susan from Forestville says, with regard to drug safety, as diabetics know all too well, for most, the drugs put on between 40 to 80 pounds. Doctors berate their patients to lose weight. In the clinics, they weigh patients every time they come in and are upset with patients' noncompliance, even though in most cases it's the drugs themselves causing the weight gain. How safe is this? And these are all approved drugs. Well, what about weight gain, Dr. Earle?
Weight gain is a real problem because, as we mentioned, insulin resistance is part of type 2 diabetes, and insulin resistance is related to overweight and obesity. And one of the reasons that actually, Avandia isn't my first choice of medications, as it does cause patients to gain weight, and that we've known ever since it was FDA approved back in 1999. However, some of the other therapies also cause weight gain. So a common medication, sulfonylureas, as well as insulin, can cause patients to gain weight, and it's very difficult. There are now some medications on the market that are weight neutral or even promote weight loss in our patients, and those are becoming more popular agents than the ones that cause weight gain, but it is a very difficult problem in treating diabetics.
I want to go to a few more emails. This is a comment from a listener named Lucy who says, excellent program. You inadvertently call attention to the need for state and federal clean money legislation to prohibit the prostitution of so-called science. Here's Mary who says, I'd like to ask a comment on the idea that drug companies have more incentive to treat diseases and less to cure diseases. Well, actually, this kind of ties in a way with another comment from a listener named Susie who says, I can understand charging a fee to pharmaceutical companies for approval processes for subsidy purposes, but how was it that drug companies were allowed to call the shots and control what the FDA looked at? Is this any different than a politician buying votes? Also, in my studies on Avandia, it appears to raise cholesterol levels, whereas Actos seems to improve them. Any comments, Dr. Ferber?
No, I think they're right. There's a difference between Actos and Avandia in terms of effect on lipids. So the Actos is much better. It raises HDL more, has less of an effect on triglycerides and on LDL cholesterol. So much better lipid profile with Actos.
What about the caller's remark, though, again, about the FDA? It's sort of like buying votes. Does that analogy seem to hold up?
Well, I mean, user fees in general, they have no restrictions on them. So the agency getting the user fees would decide how to spend the money. This, I don't understand how the drug companies got away with controlling the FDA. And there are efforts underway to get the Congress to put more money into the FDA and phase out the user fee act.
And David Magnus, when a listener says, are the drug companies more concerned about treating diseases and making money rather than curing diseases? I don't know how to answer that question. I guess it maybe depends on the drug company, doesn't it?
Actually, there's a social scientist doing research on this, but there definitely is a rise in the pharmaceutical industry and focusing on certain classes of drugs that are going to be sort of long-term lifestyle drugs. So things like statins to control cholesterol, where potentially people could be on drugs for their whole lives as opposed to a drug that we take for a short period of time and that will treat a disease. From a business point of view, those kind of drugs are likely to be much more lucrative, and there's a growing emphasis in the pharmaceutical industry on those kinds of classes of drugs for that reason. So rather than trying to cure disease, finding ways of having drugs that people will take for their whole lives.
Well, we did a whole hour on statins, in fact, and I was left with the impression that short-term things look real good, but long term there's some question marks, and that's true about a lot of drugs, really.
But that's nonetheless how they're being conceptualized in terms of their marketing, as drugs that will be lifestyle, lifelong drugs, and that is a growing emphasis within the pharmaceutical industry.
And David, join us. You're on. Good morning.
Yes, hello. I've been a type 1 for 25 years. I see one of the big problems in type 2s is that they ignore the diet and exercise. That's why they become type 2s in the first place. And another problem is that physicians do not take courses in exercise physiology and do not recognize that this is more efficacious than taking drugs like metformin and Avandia. And I know your last caller commented on this also. So I believe exercise is the whole key.
Well, here's a kind of dovetailing email from a listener named Terry. He says, I'm an obese 51-year-old man with type 2 diabetes and good glucose control using HA1C test. I take Avandia and metformin. As far as I understand, these are the only two drugs that do not either, one, place additional stress on the pancreas to produce yet more insulin that my body is not listening to well enough, or, two, are themselves a form of insulin. I hear on this program about alternatives to Avandia, but are there alternatives that do not stress the pancreas and are not insulin? Karen Earle.
There are some alternatives that do not stress the pancreas and are not insulin. There's a new class of medications for diabetes called the incretins. Again, these are new medications, so we have to be cautious when we're using them because we don't have long-term safety data. But there's been a couple different agents in this class that have been released within the last 2 years. And there's been a debate about whether or not agents that do cause the pancreas to make more insulin, causing stress to the pancreas and having long-term effects. So I think that would also still be a reasonable class or choice of medications for patients with type 2 diabetes, and those would be the sulfonylureas.
Well, this has been a most informative hour, not only on Avandia, but also about concerns that are legitimate where the FDA and regulatory agencies in general are concerned. I want to thank Stephen Nissen, who joined us earlier on, chair of the Cardiovascular Medicine Unit at Cleveland Clinic, who is the co-author of the New England Journal of Medicine report on the effects of Avandia. Also, our thanks to Dr. Karen Earle here in studio, medical director for the Center for Diabetes Services and chief of the Division of Endocrinology at California Pacific Medical Center. Thank you, Dr. Earle. Thanks to Dr. Kurt Furberg, professor of public health sciences at Wake Forest University School of Medicine. And our thanks to David Magnus, who joined us from Stanford, director of the Stanford Center for Biomedical Ethics. Thank you, David Magnus. And thanks to our listeners. We would not be here without you. We do appreciate your listenership. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, and an hour is repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. Coming up in the next hour, shifting gears, talking about, well, the gathering and dissemination of local news and how the internet technologies are affecting how people are getting news, especially local news, citizen journalism, and all that ahead. I want to thank our producers, Robin Giannatasio-Mal, Hermione G., and Kevin Guillory. Our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.